Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. Well, in this program, we answer the questions that you have related to Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad. May peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who's a faculty member at the Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor, we have many issues when it comes to be parenting, and children also face a lot of issues. For example, when there are kids, especially I have a seven-year-old who, whenever he goes outside and then after half an hour, he'll come crying home. And when I'll ask what happened, and he'll say, like, that person said this, this person said this, that boy said this, this girl said this. And he's not able to manage things, or I can say simply, not able to defend himself. So can you actually today help me as a mother to deal with my child, how I can help him defend himself when he is out in the society or playing in the playground with other kids?
Yes, that's something which we all face in early days of our lives. And we are also being bullied by people of an elder age, or even by peers who may be stronger as far as their in their maybe bodies. They are, you know, bullies. So we have situations where our children find themselves in an awkward place where they need to defend themselves. So the most important thing is we need to make them feel brave. They need to become brave people. And we need to make them understand what bravery and courage is.
All right.
As we know that courage and bravery is an attribute of our souls, of our inner spirit in our souls, where this equilibrium is developed in the feelings which we have. One of the most important feelings which we have is the instinctive feeling of anger that is there.
Yeah.
Being brave and courage is controlling that anger.
Okay.
It's not being, it's to be being offensive. It's not being, courage is not being something who is able to, you know, hit back.
Yeah.
And it's not being something, it's not that you need to be rude to someone.
Right. So when we are actually teaching our child not to, how to defend himself, the first point that you're trying to clear over here is that if someone outside was rude with him, my child should not be rude. His behavior should not be like, he should be defending himself when courage comes in. But his courage does not mean that he also uses that violent behavior, or he also is rude, or like starts hitting someone.
Exactly. It should be mostly because of self-defense. If there is any physical contact, or of self-defense, not of hurting the other person. So number one, bravery and courage. When we see in the life of Mawla Ali alayhi salam, when he is on the day of the battle of Khandaq.
All right.
When the enemy, when the foe comes and challenges all the Muslims to come and fight with him. And they have created this big ditch around Medina, and the Amr ibn Abdiwad, even with his horse, flies over to their side and challenges them and confronts them. Now Mawla Ali comes and answers his call to fight,
okay.
His invitation to fight.
All right.
And there we see that he is quite a strong enemy, a strong foe. But eventually, Mawla Ali is able to push him down.
All right.
To the floor. And he's he's now fallen to the ground, and he can't defend himself, and he carries out a very offensive thing.
Yeah, that's a very interesting story, and yes. We would want to listen that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Naqvi. And Professor is teaching us actually when our children face some unusual behavior outside their home, how should they be defending themselves? Professor, you were telling us a very beautiful story about Imam Ali al-Islam, that once he gets attacked by the enemy and now Imam Ali al-Islam gets dominant over him. Now what happens?
So there's an unfortunate thing happening. He spits in the face of Mawla Ali. And it's just about when Mawla Ali is going to, you know, kill him and chop off his head maybe. But then Mawla Ali stands up and does not kill him at that instant. So it does not seem to be a reaction, an angry reaction to the misdeed of that person.
Yeah.
He stands up, takes a brief walk and a breath, and then comes back, and then he kills him. What do we learn from this? And what did Mawla Ali say after that? He said, I did not want to
make this war personal.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I don't believe that Mawla Ali, with his so great deal of magnanimity that he had, he would even feel, angry. He had full control of his anger. It was just to show people as a lesson that don't do anything which may even feel of a personal behavior, of a personal thing, a nature. It is for the sake of Allah, it is for the sake of Islam. So number one, everything which our children do, they should realize is for the sake of Allah, it is because of Allah. And Allah has commanded us to defend ourselves. He has commanded us to defend our dignity. He has asked us to defend and protect our bodies, of our personal belongings, and ourselves.
Yeah.
He doesn't want anyone to be offensive to us, to harm us, to injure us, to rob us of our personal wealth and belonging. It is the duty, it is the command of Allah to defend ourselves.
Yeah.
So we should be, if there's a conflict, and if we have been bullied, and if someone is, you know, trying to harm us, so we need to realize that we need to keep our temper, control our temper. We shouldn't let it become a personal thing. It should not be, it should be for the sake of Allah. It should be because Allah has commanded us to defend ourselves.
All right.
And then we need to control our temper. The greatest valor and courage is controlling temper.
All right.
And that is what we find in the lifestyle of the Prophet and the Imams.
Imams, right. So you're telling actually the way we can actually teach our children not to be rude when it comes to dealing with others who offend them we got to be learning from the lives of Prophet, peace be upon him, and Imams. Well, Professor will discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "Be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we are with Professor Salman Naqvi discussing something very important, that when a child faces a situation in the society, in the playground, with his friends, where his friends are rude towards him, or sometimes they hit, sometimes they actually use a rude language, how does your child behave? How you got to be actually working on your child to behave in that kind of society? So yes, Professor, do we have some more tips?
Yes, so we need to understand that when they want to defend themselves, they need to keep their temper. They should not be offensive. They should not be rude. They should not hit back just because of the fact they need to be hitting back. It shouldn't be a brick for a stone, maybe. It should be for the sake of personal defense, just to keep ourselves away from harm. So we need to, teach our children personal defense, self-defense, as a, from their early childhood.
Yeah.
We should send them to, even girls should go to classes.
For self-defense.
Of self-defense.
Yeah. But sometimes when kids are of a very tender age, like, for example, I remember sitting in a gathering where there were these 70-year-old boys who were going to the school, and then one of the boys had beaten the seniors at school with his water bottle. And then when he was asked at home why, and he replies that these senior boys were not letting me go into the playground or play everywhere. And then when parents can actually inquire about the entire situation, the situation is that the senior students are authorized to maintain discipline at the school, and they are not they have to be taking control, that they do not allow each and every student to be coming into the ground. But this newcomer child does not know that these are the seniors and they're teaching me rules. So this child does not have the capability to actually receive that orders from seniors. So what do we do with such children?
Yes, of course. Especially at home, when they've been taught to take care of some rules and regulations, then when they go into the school, sometimes the way the seniors treat the young ones who are coming in, they have a very unfortunate way of doing it.
Yeah.
They have a very wrong way of doing it. Sometimes it happens, especially in cadet schools, in army schools. The seniors who want to welcome the juniors, they do carry out things which are very, very repugnant. Sometimes it has led to the deaths of new cadets also, unfortunately. It has happened over the in the past. But but they should be, number one, self-defense. Number two, a child from the beginning should be able to
accept the rules.
Number three, should be able to work in teams and groups.
Okay.
That is important. We need to teach our children to become good team workers.
All right.
So, and we need to make our children say no.
Say no.
Confidently.
Well, that needs more discussion, and we will discuss that with you in another episode. So what is important over here is that we got to be teaching our children rudeness is not to be answered with rudeness always, and work in teams, work in groups, and accept rules, accept laws, accept discipline, and that they will accept only when we as parents will have some rules and discipline at home. Thank you so much, Professor. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam Islam says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to control our anger. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me for this session. We're going to start our program today with a question, and that is that someone has asked, what would you suggest to cure my quick anger and emotion, which is called stress by psychologists? To answer this very important question, I would say that I am answering you with a full conviction that if you follow the answer, you will get the result. Otherwise, you will remain as you are. So the cure is a mixture of moral and practical matters. So you should follow the principles we have above us here. So firstly, for controlling our anger, we need to recite the fact of submission to Allah so that your heart feels peaceful with the emotion of Allah, the Almighty. And then you will see the things that provoke you simple and easy. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z, IRB English Radio, Call of Islam page. And we are here together to talk about how to control our stress. So, for the first principle that we can study through Quran and Hadith is reciting submissions, reciting Quran, because it makes our heart in peace and we feel peaceful in our, and we feel peaceful. And it makes our heart live in ease. But the second principle that we can study from Quran and Hadith, that is always be legally pure, okay? So this is a very important condition to be. For example, if something has happened to us, we have to make ablution, we have to make wudu, we have to make ghusl. So we should always be legally pure. And thirdly, do not commit any sin, because committing sins will darken our heart, and when our heart gets darkened, we feel stress, we feel angry. And fourthly, we need to keep away from anything that provokes our nervous. And fifthly, always keep your tongue busy with the remembrance of Allah, and especially with the certain glorification like La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah al-aliyy al-azim, or at the istighfar, that it means I pray to Allah to forgive me. Also, this kind of remembrance will make us feel peaceful and will put our heart in ease. Also, drink cold water whenever you provoked. And also, you can pull some on your head and say salawat. And separately, go to an open place to breathe fresh air, to look at as far as you can, and at the end, be totally indifferent to the thing that causes your anger. Tell yourself that you are more precious than that, and so it does not behoove you to exhaust your power and harm yourself. I hope everyone a life full of peace and ease. Thank you for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
At least 34 Palestinians, including 6 children, have been killed in the recent Israeli regime bombing campaign. This is while Biden administration quietly backs the Zionist regime's deadly assault on Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Throughout wrote in this regard, more concerning, if expected, is the U.S. officials' clear refusal to acknowledge that the Israeli regime sparked this latest escalation and has continued to pour fuel over the fire. The U.S. State Department spokesperson, Vedant Patel, was confronted by Palestinian journalist Saeed Arigat on this question. Notably, right before Arigat spoke, Matthew Lee of the Associated Press expressed his exasperation with Patel, prefacing his own questions about the Zionist regime by declaring that he didn't expect Patel to respond with any substance. Arigat asked if the U.S. State Department had any comment on the fact that Israelis broke a ceasefire and killed children in the middle of the night while they were sleeping. Patel's response was every bit as dissembling and empty as Lee had anticipated. Patel said, "We continue to call on both sides to take steps that will not incite tensions and further incite violence. We have continued to call on both sides, on our Israeli partners and the Palestinian Authority, to continue to take prudent steps to ensure that the loss of civilian life is prevented and that steps are taken to ensure that violence is reduced and these kind of events don't happen. That is exactly why we continue to pursue our efforts for a two-state solution and continue to pursue our efforts for equal measures of prosperity, security, and freedom," Patel claimed. Patel's comments clearly indicate the lack of value the Biden administration places on Palestinian life. At this point, the mantra of two-state solution is a strong indicator of a total absence of any desire to protect the rights or the lives of Palestinians, given that only the most delusional or willfully dishonest can even pretend to put it forth as a viable solution anymore. But the additional Biden talking point of equal measures of prosperity, security, and freedom is an even stronger indication of having nothing to offer. But even beyond those indicators, Patel gave away the game when discussing who the Biden administration claimed to work with. Their Israeli partners have made it quite clear they don't take Biden at all seriously and, with good reason, expect him to dutifully support them with money and diplomatic help, regardless of their actions. The bankruptcy of the American position and the impotence of the Biden administration are reflected as much in the current state of play as they were at the beginning. When Blinken met with Israeli regime Foreign Minister Cohen, the readout of their call stated that the secretary noted the importance of recent meetings in Aqaba and Sharm el-Sheikh aimed at de-escalating tensions and urged that both Israel and the Palestinian Authority take additional steps to stabilize the situation in the West Bank and promote a durable calm. That was just days after Khazar Adnan's death and mere hours before the Israeli regime broke the ceasefire and launched its assault on Gaza. The irony is that the agreements at Aqaba and Sharm el-Sheikh, both of which the Zionist regime publicly and clearly abrogated almost immediately after they were announced, committed neither Israeli regime nor the United States to any significant steps to ease Palestinian suffering, but did commit the PA to restore security cooperation with Israel and to take steps in Palestinian cities like Nablus and Jenin to crack down on new and popular groups. In other words, they were both agreements to escalate confrontation, human rights abuses, and violence. It's long been a cliché to talk about how the U.S. regime makes this already vexing crisis worse through its dishonest behavior and defiance of all ethical, legal, and even pragmatic considerations in its supports of the fabricated regime of Israel. But 75 years after the Nakba and the Zionist regime's creation, the Biden administration seems determined to top all its predecessors in trampling the rights and hopes of the Palestinian people.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. This is Youth Station. Welcome back to a new episode of your own program. I am Asma, at your service, and I have Brother Hassanain with me. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Hope you all are doing well. This is Hassanain, and you're listening to Youth Station. How are you, sister?
Thank you. Everything is just fine. How are you?
Alhamdulillah, I'm doing good.
So, what about your seminary studies? Do you have exams right now?
Yeah, exams most probably in like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
We have our exams.
And are you ready for that?
Yeah, like we are getting ready for it. Like we still have our classes and, you know, after the classes, we're going to revise for lessons and we'll be having exams after that.
So wish you luck with that. Are you a competition person? Well, as for me, I don't think so. I am not. I do not feel any competition.
I used to be, you know, while I was in my like third, fourth standard, like when I was really small.
Usually at a school that happens.
Yeah, but now it doesn't matter. Like, you know, our class, you know, it used to be, you know, we used to have exams and then after that, we used to get our report cards, like result. So it used to be mentioned, like, you know, the first rank, the second rank, like whoever scored the highest gets the first rank, then second, third, fourth. So that time, I used to be in that range, right? So like first and second and third. So I used to be in that range. So it really used to matter to me, like, you know, you know, once I get
and
first.
And then what happened when it no longer matters?
Yeah, so like I used to be in that range. You know, first of all, you know, it matters, you know, why does it matter?
Yeah.
You know, what are the factors when I was in that range? So sometimes I used to get the first rank, sometimes the second rank.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was playing between those ranks. So I wanted to be in those ranks. So that used to matter. But the guys who are like, you know, who come after 10, 15.
Yes.
It doesn't matter if they're 15 or if they're 10.
Exactly. I guess all of us have got that experience when we were out of school. At that time, we cared too much about being the among the three persons who are the first three students of the class. We cared too much about that. But as we got older, as we get to go to university and then see that your number is not actually going to show your true knowledge, then we understand that, okay, there is no competition, honestly.
Right.
As long as you care about your, you know, your improvement, that is the thing that matters too much.
Then gradually as, you know, time passed by, you know, university and then seminary. So now like competition, you know, getting, you know, being first in the class, you know, scoring more than others. It doesn't really matter now. So it doesn't mean that, you know, someone who is, you know, an average student, so he doesn't care about the competition. Like, you know, even the, you know, the what do you call that? The smartest student of the class, even now, you know, we don't care. We really don't care about, you know, scoring more than others.
Yeah, because you have came to this conclusion that what matters is the knowledge itself.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So, you know, score or your marks, it's just a number, right?
Yeah, it's just a number.
It doesn't decide your knowledge. You know, someone who have scored 50 might have more knowledge than someone who has scored 100. He might have more experience. So these numbers they don't decide your knowledge. They don't decide your abilities and they don't decide your future.
Exactly. This is the point. They are not going to decide your future. But generally speaking, competition is a good thing. You know, when you lose that sense of competition, then maybe you're not going to be as speedy as the time when you were in a competition.
Again, every coin has two sides.
Yeah.
So there's a positive side of the competition and there's a negative side of the competition.
Yeah.
So
what are the positives and what are the negatives?
Okay, the positive side of the competition is...
you will compete with others and that will make you...
Yeah, the positive sides and the negative sides. So the positive side is, you know, it motivates you to improve yourself.
And it's very important.
Yeah, it's important. So it motivates you to improve yourself. But and the negative side is just the fact of the competition is you're competing with someone else. So this leads to something in your heart. This leads to a feeling that he...
Always comparing yourself to others.
Yeah, you're comparing yourself to others and your fellow competitor, who is your classmate, who is your friend. You don't want him to score well.
Yeah.
You don't want him to perform better.
Exactly. As if they're your enemies.
Yeah, so...
You're in different fronts.
Yeah, you see them as your competitor. You see them as your rivals.
Yeah.
So this is the negative side of it.
You would set barricades as if you're in a battlefield.
Yeah, but the positive side is when you're competing with yourself. Like you see, okay, You know, I performed my 80%.
Yeah.
So next time I would perform my 90%. I would give my 90%.
That's a very nice point. And I guess right now, in order to think more about what just Brother Hassani mentioned, let's go for a break, have a sip of water, and then we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Youth Station. Well, dear youth, we're talking about competition. I guess it's not everybody's favorite discussion.
So, as we were discussing about the positive and the negative side of the competition, I guess, you know, competition can be parallel to hasad and ghibta.
Jealousy.
Envy, more envy, I would say, envy. Like envy. And ghibta is the good or the positive envy. So hasad is
that you wish you could have that thing that you are feeling jealous
exactly.
about.
Exactly. So the difference between the good envy and the bad envy is, you know, in the bad envy, you do not want your fellow competitor or your rival to have certain things.
Yeah.
You know, if he has a good car, so you don't like it. Mm-hmm. You say, hey, why does he have a better car than mine?
Mm-hmm.
But what is envy? When you see that your neighbor has a better car than yours, you say, oh, his car is so nice. I wish I would have had the same car
then
as
well. Then you would take all of your energy in order to invest much of your talent in order
exactly.
to gain it.
So this is the positive competition.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. Like, you know, the hasad and the ghibta, like the good envy and the bad envy.
Mm-hmm.
Like the positive competition and the bad competition, the negative competition.
Yeah.
So this negative competition sometimes leads you to jealousy, and sometimes it leads you to, and a lot of times it leads you for your friends not to have what you're competing
for. Exactly, and sometimes you might cause them some damage in the bad, in
just to win
jealousy.
The competition,
yeah.
Right?
In jealousy, you would wish the other one to be damaged, to be hurt, and
yeah.
you don't care. But in envy, you would actually wish something, but you do not wish the otherwise for the person that you are feeling envied.
Right, yes. You just say that, you know, may Allah give him more.
Yeah, yeah.
And may Allah give me as well.
Yeah, and consider me along him or her.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the thing about competition, but not all people have that feeling and desire in themselves. I have seen many people, you know, even at school, I remember that we had some classmates who were so, I saw it in them. They were so much of a genius, I would have said,
mm-hmm.
even in that time. But they did not try to get into the competition. They did not have any, they did not feel actually that they have to get into any competition. That's why they usually didn't try more to improve themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the marks came, the scores came. They were the people who were oppressed because they were genius, but
mm-hmm.
just they got lesser numbers and scores. And, you know, that evaluation of us in that class was not very much fair. So all I meant to say is that even that feeling of competition to exist in a person, I guess, is a blessing
mm-hmm.
because that would make you improve yourself.
Yeah, that creates a motivation in yourself so that you try to improve yourself. It
mm-hmm.
motivates you, it inspires
yeah.
you.
But how as a person who has lost this feeling, how can I create some more of that myself? But before that, let's go for a break and then we'll be back.
Thank you.
Yes, this is the last part of today's episode, and I said when somebody loses their feeling of competition, what they can do to bring it back.
Okay, since if we are talking about the positive competition, rather I would say like when someone loses the motivation to improve themselves, you know, it's usually due to the fact that they think that, you know, it's not my cup of tea. Like the thing that they cannot do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like they are actually genius, so just they don't believe in themselves. And the thing that, you know, it's not possible for me. So this, yeah. Due to this reason, they lose the sense of competing with others. They lose the sense of, you know, improving themselves in the specific field.
Yeah.
So what we need to understand over here, so we being the youth, we need to understand that, you know, first of all, we should start to believe in ourselves.
Yeah.
That what can we do?
And gain confidence.
Yeah, and what are our abilities?
Yeah.
Because there is a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, "Man arafa nafsa, faqad arafa Rabba." Whoever has recognized himself has recognized his Lord.
The creator.
So, you know, when he recognizes himself, like what are his capabilities, what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given him.
Yeah.
You know, this can motivate him back. So,
you know what I would say? There's another way to improve that feeling in you, to let it just grow. If it has been just off, you can turn it on. Get involved in a circle of successful people.
Exactly. Yeah. And this, you know, being around aimless people,
yeah,
or hopeless people, that might dull your motivation.
Exactly.
Be around the people because your company really matters.
Your company does matter, and your friend
circle, it's a very important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Your friend circle decides your future. They shape your future. Yeah. You know, you have friends like, you know, okay, I'll do, you know, I'll study this at my university and then I'll do master's and apply for a job over there. You know, I'll get this job. Some people that, you know, they decide your future.
Yeah,
and the people, you know, they don't really care about anything. It's, you know, they don't study. You know, they just hang out.
Well, just let me tell you an experience of my own self. Sure. Well, I have this group of friends. And then among my friends, there are some members whom whenever I go out with them, after when I come back home, I feel like I do not have the energy to do anything, literally anything. I feel like I'm drained. But there are some others, when I talk to them, I feel like right now I can even go to the skies and fly over the skies and do everything that I want. Because just as you said, it is very important who is your company. The good company who has got too much of passion for life, for getting improved, for flourishing themselves, would give you the same ideas and feelings. You would feel like, yes, I am motivated to go further and do more and more. If you feel that there is any competition, first of all, you should take this into notice that the bad sort of competing with other people is not going to lead you to somewhere that you would be prosperous. No, it would, the table will turn against you. But then the good sort of competing is the one that would actually motivate you to improve yourself, to get better, to show a more improved version of yourself. Yeah.
And choose your friends who inspire you and who bring you closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and closer to Deen and motivate you in every aspect of your life.
Yeah, so this was all the time that we had for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
About you. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Thanks to the resolve and resistance of the Palestinians, who over the past few days offered martyrs and shattered the myth of military mighty of the Zionists, the end of Israel is near, and in the near future, the spurious, terroristic, and racist regime of Israel will cease to exist, no matter what military and monetary help the Americans and the Europeans provide. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International noted, May 15th, the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, or a great catastrophe that saw the expulsion of some million Palestinians from their homes and hearts, a day after Britain gave birth to the illegitimate Zionist entity, has brought into sharper focus the fast approaching end of Israel. May 15th is the Black Day in history, which depicts the story of a nation deprived of its homeland, on which the occupiers who came from across the seas set up a spurious state in 1948 and have since subjected the sons of the soil to all sorts of atrocities. The five-day unprovoked aerial attacks on Gaza that the usurper regime was forced to end recently because of the barrage of missiles of the defenders piercing the so-called Iron Dome and causing panic among the illegal settlers, once again busted the myth of Israel's military superiority. It also exposed as lies the remarks of certain European backers of the Zionists that Israel has made the desert bloom and the Palestinians lack the capability, knowledge, or desire to develop agriculture in the region. This is indeed a preposterous lie and a convenient disguise by the Israeli regime to degrade and destroy Palestine's natural resources and a means of obfuscating one of the worst occupations in modern history by wrapping it in the cloak of Zionist mythology. To speak otherwise, historical documents prove that prior to 1948, Palestinian farms were very productive, and the local Arabs, both Muslims and Christians, were successful farmers. For example, a UN report on agriculture in Palestine between 1945 and 1946 records that Palestinian-grown crops accounted for nearly 80% of Palestine's total agricultural yield that season, with Palestinian farms producing over 244,000 tons of vegetables, 73,000 tons of fruit, and 78,000 tons of olives. 2 years later, in 1948, when the majority of Palestinians were forced to flee from their homeland during the Nakba, the farms and orchards tended by them were left abandoned, as their owners fled under the threat of death at the hands of Zionist militias. The Zionists actually began harvesting the crops that had ripened in the abandoned fields and picking the citrus fruit in Arab groves in what could be called land theft, and proves the lie of the so-called agricultural expertise of Zionist occupiers. The current Zionist policy, especially the construction of illegal Jewish settlements on Palestinian land, is the continuation of this effort to erase Palestinian territory. The result has been the current horrendous drought, the worst the region has faced in over 900 years and is among the reasons of the continuing protests by hundreds of thousands of illegal Jewish settlers who have begun to realize that they were deceived. This means the fabricated regime of Israel has not improved the land by making the desert bloom as alleged, but instead degraded the land where its native inhabitants, the Palestinians, were better caretakers. Anyway, thanks to the resolve and resistance of the Palestinians who over the past few days offered martyrs and shattered the myth of military might of the Zionists, the end of the fabricated regime of Israel is near, and in the near future, the spurious regime of Israel will cease to exist, no matter what military and monetary help the Americans and the Europeans provide. In the meantime, the website of Middle East Eye reported thousands of people marched in London recently commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, or catastrophe, which refers to the mass forced expulsion of Palestinians by Zionist militias to make way for the creation of Israel in 1948. The demonstration titled Nakba 75, End Apartheid, End the Occupation, gathered in the heart of London outside the BBC headquarters before participants made their way to Downing Street, where the office of the British Prime Minister is located. Lean Muhammad, a British Palestinian activist attending the rally, told the Middle East Eye, "The Nakba was not just a singular event. Today we are still living the effect of the Nakba. 75 years ago, my family was expelled from their home in Haifa, Palestine, by Zionist militias. They ended up as refugees in Lebanon. Three quarters of a century later, they are still living in that same refugee camp." The London event was organized by the Palestinian Forum in Britain, Friends of Al-Aqsa, the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, PSC, and the Muslim Association of Britain. "We mark the Nakba not just as a historical event, but as a continuing process of oppression enacted over the past 75 years through ongoing colonization of land, enforcement of apartheid and military occupation," said PSC on its website. The march was attended by the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, who has been a lifeline campaigner against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Corbyn, in a message on Twitter, said, "Today we march through London to mark the 75th anniversary of Nakba and speak out against the ongoing dispossession of the Palestinian people. End the occupation. Free Palestine."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on April 18th, 2023. The late Mr. Talighani told me the day when Imam Khomeini said the Shah must go, I thought, what is he talking about? Now, Mahmoud Talighani was no ordinary person. In other words, someone like the late Ayatollah Talighani, a profound fighter with all the great history that he had, was not optimistic about this. But it happened. The revolution was victorious. I shall surely prevail, I and my messengers. All the imposed war of Iraq upon Iran. You weren't around then. You didn't see it. The imposed war was a strange event. Everyone was against us. The US was against us. The Soviet Union was against us. NATO was against us. Muslim countries were against us. Our neighbor, Turkey, was against us. Everyone. But we were victorious. In such a war, where everyone was against us, we were victorious. Therefore, our experience shows us the same thing. This is what awaiting the reappearance of the Savior is about. Awaiting the reappearance does not mean that we should just sit around waiting and praying that God will send Imam Mahdi ajjalallahu ta'ala farajah sharif to us. Nevertheless, praying for his reappearance is something obligatory that we must do.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We need to pray. We must want this. We need to pursue it, but that's not enough. Awaiting the reappearance means that whenever there is a problem in the things we are doing, we need to believe that the time of the reappearance that we are awaiting will come. A person needs to have this expectation. Of course, there are certain necessary conditions. We need to make an effort. Awaiting the Savior means that when you want to eat bread, you need to go to the bakery and buy the bread first. The bread is not going to come to you if you want to sit at home and wait for it. Action needs to be taken for the reappearance to occur. These are the principles that require work. There are many such principles, or there is the principle of monotheism. A sovereign other than God is forbidden. Monotheism means the negation of the sovereignty of other than God. And there are numerous other similar examples. Your associations particularly need to work on these principles. And don't focus on a small, limited point. Widen your perspective. Look at all the issues.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me. Through all my years, I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.